You're with us for a year-end Economics Explainer on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're going around the horn on economic issues, rewinding some of the economic indicators throughout the year and what they mean. Starting, though, with a new trade deal for North America, the Trump administration's U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement passed the House yesterday. Vote in the Senate is expected early next year. So what questions do you have about how this multi-country trade deal impacts our overall economy? Has your business been hit by tariffs this year? How did you compensate for that? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Patty Hirsch is editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. He's been an economics and finance news correspondent and editor for 20 years. He also writes historical fiction. His new book is called Hudson's Kill, and he joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Patty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So when NAFTA was enacted in 1994, rewinding here, it was really blamed for the loss of millions of factory jobs that moved to Mexico, where wages were lower. Will this NAFTA 2.0 reverse those losses?
Well, you may remember, well, I certainly remember, that the quote was that there would be a giant sucking sound of jobs being sucked south to Mexico, as you say. But I don't think that we're going to hear a sort of a reverse vacuuming sound of jobs going back north. There's no doubt that the rules have changed, and it's a good thing that, trade agreements are renegotiated after time. I haven't got an issue with that at all. But the contention that all of these jobs are going to return to the United States is just plain wrong. You know, firstly, auto companies are going to have to make not that many more of a car's components in the United States. It was 62.5%. It's now 75%. And at least 30% of the cars of the car right now, it has to be made by workers earning at least $16 an hour. That goes up to 40% in 2023. So it's a 10% increase over the next 3 years. Now, that's clearly that, you know, if you're today going to have to make that move, clearly you'd have to move some of those jobs north. But we're talking 3 years away. And that's, you know, we're already seeing American factories changing the way that they work in a very big way. And in a lot of people who've been looking at this reckon that the long-term winners in this are not going to be American workers, but are going to be companies who exist in the automation and robotics space, who are going to be able to put robots in place. And so you may see a few jobs coming north, but really not that many. The other issue, of course, is that this is going to make cars more expensive if it actually does happen, and that could reduce U.S. jobs for cars sold to China, because the cars are going to be too expensive for the Chinese market. So although you may see the number of jobs increase for cars that are being made, under NAFTA to go to other parts of the world, that's not going to include China, because the Chinese are going to be able to buy, they're going to want to buy their cars elsewhere, because these American cars are going to be too expensive. And that's going to be a problem, and that could also erode jobs.
Well, even if the gains are modest here, doesn't a renegotiated trade deal help businesses at the end of the day, because there's stability?
Well, absolutely. I mean, stability is always a good thing. And like I say, you're absolutely right. There's trade deals should never be set in stone, right? They should never be sort of laid, put in aspic and left there forever. They should be constantly being renegotiated. And it's a good thing that this deal has been renegotiated. But let's just not overestimate what it's going to, the effects that it's going to have on the U.S. job market. It is going to, provide companies with more certainty, and that allows them to plan for the future. Then they can make a decision, whether to automate or whether to buy other companies, or whether to expand or whether to contract. And this does this, and that's a good thing, and it's why Democrats got on board and voted for it yesterday, rather than trying to stick a thumb in the eye of President Trump, which they've been trying to do for some time. So that is why this passed. They got a lot of people got a lot of the things that they wanted out of it, and that's a good thing. So yes.
We're talking with Patty Hirsch, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money, and he's been an economics and finance news correspondent a long time. We're doing a rewind on the year in economics. Have you been following all the back and forth on tariffs between China and the U.S.? What do you think of President Trump's trade policy? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Patty, 2019 was really marked by escalating tariffs, this trade war with China. China and the U.S. reached a limited trade agreement recently. What do we know about where we're at with this trade war?
We don't know very much. I mean, all we know is that Relations between China and the United States have really soured. And what we do know is that we do know what the cost, we can get a good sense of what the cost is that of that's going to be right now, even with this sort of pause that we put, that we heard about the other day. You know, China tariffs are still going to cost us about $316 billion by the end of 2020, even with this trade deal. And the big thing about this is that even if tomorrow these people all get in a room and they come up with an agreement that solves these trade issues, the fact is, and I've been speaking to people all over the world who work with China and who depend on the U.S.-China relationship, and that includes American businesses who used to operate in China, because a lot of those businesses have said this is too much for us. We have to regroup. We have to start thinking about different ways to do business. And they have in many cases this trade spat has broken the relationship between American corporations, especially smaller corporations that can't weather this kind of uncertainty for a long time. It has broken that relationship and has, as a result, taken huge toll on companies that are trying to import and export with China. And that is one of the biggest things that nobody's really talked about right now. A lot of people have talked about the effect that it's had on businesses in the United States, which is considerable, and the effect that it's had on consumers in the United States, which is not so considerable, but will bite as time goes on. But that relationship between American businesses that do business in China right now, though in many cases, those relationships have been destroyed.
When you say billions of dollars in costs, is that specifically to the consumers, the farmers, the manufacturers, the retailers? Who is hurting here?
Well, in the main, it's the big businesses, right? You know, again, who can weather these kinds of storms? If you're talking about, you know, a General Motors or a large, you know, a company that's producing large amounts of goods or even agricultural goods that are exporting to China or buying goods from China that they need to put into their supply chains in order to produce goods, those big companies, they're taking the biggest share of this hit. Smaller companies can only take so much before they start to go out of business. And you're already hearing about that in farms throughout the United States. Small farms are being eroded at a massive rate, much, much more quickly than they were over the last decade, because they can't sell into this market. It means that they can't make the amount of money that they used to make, and so they're closing down. Of course, large farms benefit from this because then they can buy these smaller businesses. So really, the hit that you're seeing in the short term is on these small businesses, but in the long term, where the money is really being spent to absorb these costs is in these large companies.
Well, another major news story this year was Brexit. Earlier this year, you told us not to worry about Brexit, but let's rewind on that. What is happening now, and how should we be paying attention or not?
Well, Americans don't, again, I know I said this a year ago, so I'll say it again. Americans don't have to worry too much about Brexit, right? The big dog in this fight is Europe. And America has a trading relationship with Europe. The fact that Britain isn't going to be part of Europe going forward shouldn't be a problem because America will negotiate a separate deal with the United Kingdom. So, you know, you're going to have two deals as opposed to one deal, which is exactly what, people in the Trump administration like. They don't like these large multilateral deals. They say they like independent individual deals, or, you know, bilateral deals with individual nations. So that's a good thing for them. So the problem really for, you know, if you're worried about getting your sausage rolls or whatever it is, your baked beans, you know, it is from the UK, that you're not going to have to worry about that too much. They're still going to come. They may be a little bit more expensive. They may be cheaper because the United States, if Britain thinks it's going to get a favorable treatment in the negotiation with the United States when it comes to a trade deal, they can forget about it. The U.S. is going to be every bit as aggressive with the negotiation of that deal that they are with any other organization. So, but, you know, American consumers, American businesses don't have to worry about it too much.
Betty Hirsch, editor of the Planet Money podcast, The Indicator. He's our guide as we rewind on the year in economics, get some explanations along the way. What are your questions about the economy in 2019 and looking forward? Are you curious about trade, consumer debt, unemployment numbers, the repo market, anything else? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Patty Hirsch. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking back at the year in economics, how our financial systems all work. We're going to be exploring the world's most competitive economies and what that really means. Should we be concerned that the U.S. recently lost the number one spot in the world financial economic rankings? Is this the start of a new trend. What economic indicators do you want more context on? Join in 800-642-1234 with your questions. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We have economics and finance news correspondent Patty Hirsch by our side. He stays with us for the hour. Let's go to the phones now. Mike is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks. I kind of lost track of what the timeline was for the big tax cuts that went through. I wasn't sure. I can't remember. It was last December or December before. But what was the true impact of those tax cuts? How did they affect corporations? How did they affect the...
Great question, Mike. Thank you.
Great question, Mike. Well, a lot of people rejoiced. You know, a lot of people who felt that they were being taxed too much, which include corporations, rejoiced. And, you know, you can see the effect of this in the economy because, we're seeing the economy growing just as well as it has been for the last 18 years. You know, we've not seen economic growth of more than 3.5% year on year for that period. All right. So, you know, we're seeing economic growth continues. But what we are seeing is a very low unemployment rate. And that means that's because companies feel that they're able to spend money on hiring more workers. So, you know, you can take that view. You can say, well, these tax cuts firstly boosted the middle class and enabled them to spend more, which they have been doing. Consumer spending has been up and consumer confidence is very good, although that's a kind of a wobbly metric for pretty much anything, actually, when it comes to the economy, because it goes up and down so quickly. Mm. But business confidence is very good. Business confidence is high. They feel that they are, because they've had this tax cut, they're able to spend more money and they have been hiring more workers, and that's a good thing. Now, of course, you may say to yourself, well, how good are those jobs, right? You know, how much do they pay? Because the average rate of pay, of course, in the United States is not going up that much. It's going up a little, but wages are still not going up particularly high. And also the quality of those jobs, you know, how much protection do they have, you know, in terms of do they have insurance? You know, are people, do they have long-term contracts? Those kinds of things. So you can talk a lot about the quality of those jobs. But there's absolutely no doubt that the tax cuts have had a net benefit to the economy. Now, a lot of people will say, well, that's kind of a sugar high. And how long are those tax cuts going to persist? And if we kept going in this vein, would it be a good thing? And that's a point for debate because we can't look into the future. But there's no doubt short term, those tax cuts have been beneficial overall to the economy.
Mike, thanks. Let's bring in Jeremy now in Racine with a question. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question. 2019, the Fed pumped in roughly over $70 billion into our banking sector. What was the reasons behind that? And do we have something to be alarmed out come 2020? Anytime I hear about the Fed pumping more money into the banking sector, they're not staying, what is that word, liquidity is not very strong right now. So I'm just kind of curious what's going on with the banking sector and is there any potential downfall come 2020 with them?
Yeah. Jeremy, thanks. Patty, how are our banks doing?
Well, it's a great question, you know, about this whole issue of, the quantitative easing that we did, you know, back whenever the financial crisis hit. And, you know, the government made a decision to pump vast amounts of money into the banking sector in order to shore up the banks, in order to keep the economy moving. And that appears to have worked. And there's a school of thought that says, you know, we should continue doing this. We should continue, having this era of easy money where interest rates are low, very low, where people can borrow very easily, where debt basically drives the economy. And that includes government debt, where we have a huge amount of money on the balance sheet. And we just continue to roll that over as opposed to pay it off. Now, a lot of people will say, well, that's extremely dangerous. It's, you know, what happens if the economy turns? You know, then suddenly rates could start to go up and companies could start to go out of business. Individuals could start to go bankrupt. You know, there's a real specter there that people point to. And I'm not, you know, who knows? They may well be right. Right now, we seem to be in this situation where the president is encouraging, extremely low borrowing rates. And the Federal Reserve, while not necessarily obliging the president, has certainly fallen into line in some respect by saying, yes, let's keep interest rates low. As opposed to hiking them up last year, they've decided to turn around and drop them and hold them at a relatively low level. And, you know, I personally believe that this is a bit of a sugar high, that the economy, it can operate on very, very cheap debt so people can borrow easily and they can spend. But that to me is dangerous because it means that everyone's living on borrowed money as opposed to earned money. You know, as I said earlier, we're not seeing wages rise that much. So it means that people don't have that much money in their bank accounts that they're saving and they're spending just like a normal, well-adjusted household would do. They're living on debt. And I personally think that that's a problem.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at household debt in just a bit. Talking with Patty Hirsch, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. We're looking back at the year in economics and what these indicators look like. Consumer debt has been up in the last year. Have you experienced this personally? Have you had to pinch pennies more than usual? Dairy farmers, what about you? Has your personal debt grown in the past year, or have you been able to keep afloat? Join in with your perspective, your situation, your questions about the economy, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Patty, let's look at the Global Competitiveness Report. This is a yearly report published by the World Economic Forum, and it's designed to as an index. What does it look at?
Well, it looks at a variety of things. I mean, it's not an indicator that I look at that much, but it's something that, you know, people like it. It makes a little bit of news, you know, because it rates people back and forth. But it looks at a number of categories in an economy, like, you know, how solid the institutions are, what the infrastructure in the country looks like, you know, how much they've adopted information and communications technology, how good healthcare is, how good skills are amongst workers, you know, what the labor market looks like generally, how solid the financial system is. You know, so the more kind of the more advanced and the more complex those parts are, and the less corruption there is, which is a very big part of this, the more likely the country is to be competitive.
And Singapore fared very well on this report.
Yeah, so Singapore, it's interesting to hear Singapore right now, especially in light of what we were talking about earlier, Brexit, because, you know, one of Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party's big mantras has been of creating a Singapore on Thames. You know, Singapore has become this kind of this icon of a developed market economy that functions extremely well, particularly a service economy. And, you know, Singapore has really set itself apart in Asia, you know, not part of China, obviously. It's an independent nation. And when it was started by Lee Kuan Yew after the end of the Second World War, it made a really specific effort to be as progressive, if you like, as possible in terms of the way that it approached business in Asia, and it adopted as many sort of Western-style market characteristics as it possibly could. And that's really paying off today, as we can see, because it pipped the post with the United States in the Global Competitive Index this year.
Well, we have Jason at WPR who wants you to explain modern monetary theory.
His friends he wants me to explain it?
Yeah, his friends have been talking about it this year, and he feels like he's late to the party on this economic concept. What is modern monetary theory, and where is it coming from?
All right, so it's this thing called modern monetary theory, MMT. You'll hear it brought down to, and it's become quite popular with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And the theory is that governments who have a fiat currency system, which is what we have and most Western economies do, which is that it's fiat. It's not based on anything you can hold in your hand. It's like, you know, a dollar is worth a dollar because I say it is. It's by fiat, all right, rather than having, you know, a dollar's worth of gold backing it up, which we used to have back under the gold system. Anyway, the idea is if you have this type of currency where a dollar is worth what you say it is, and you can print it, right? You can just print it with a couple of keystrokes. Then the theory is that a government that has that system can print as much money as it needs to spend because it can't go broke or insolvent unless a political decision to do so is taken, right? So this is, we can just print money.
Yeah.
Now, immediately, you know, people like me, old school people like me, maybe, who think, oh my gosh, this sounds horrendous because isn't this incredibly
chaos,
fiscally irresponsible,
yeah,
right? The debt's going to balloon. Inflation's going to skyrocket. But a lot of people who espouse MMT, and there are some serious academics who do, I wouldn't say they're in the mainstream, but some people do, they say, well, you know, because the US can sustain much greater deficits without cause for concern, and a small deficit or surplus can actually be, it's a small deficit or surplus that would be more harmful, you know, then we should be able to operate like this. We don't have to tax in the way that we do. We don't have to print bonds or lend money in the way that we do in order to raise money. We can actually do it just by printing money. Now, most the vast majority of economic thinkers, you know, even on the left wing, economists like Paul Krugman even are quite skeptical of this idea. But it is gaining a lot of adherence because in many cases, Democrats say, well, you know, a lot of the time we inherit these situations from Republicans where Republican premiers or Republican presidents have spent like crazy on pet projects and then they get voted out of office and then the Democrats come in and have to deal with this. Well, I think that's a little disingenuous, frankly. I think that, you know, people are going to talk a lot more about MMT, but okay. I think when you dig into it, it looks a little dangerous.
We'll keep it on the radar. Exploring the biggest economic questions and developments of 2019 with Patty Hirsch as our guide. He's editor of the Planet Money podcast, The Indicator. We're going to zoom in on household debt and our pocketbooks. Did you borrow more this year to make ends meet? Have you had to pinch pennies? What do you attribute your current financial situation to? Join in with your story, your questions about economics, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Patty Hirsch right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're recapping the year in economics here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Nearly a third of American consumers have delinquent debt, and in some states and counties, the share of people with overdue bills is even higher. The D.C.-based Urban Institute released a report this week called Debt in America, and it's based on information they pulled from millions of credit records. So is your family living with financial stress? Is your take-home pay enough to cover your bills? You'll need more money tomorrow to buy the same things you buy today. Will you receive a cost of living raise this year? Is it keeping up with inflation? And by the way, what do you want to know about inflation? Join in 800-642-1234. Patty Hirsch is the editor of the Planet Money podcast, The Indicator, and he's our guide through the hour. Patty, we had a call from Mike in Green Bay earlier about tax cuts, and Chris from Grafton also wants to know if corporations that received big tax cuts have been investing more into their facilities, making capital investments, or are they buying back their stock instead?
A little bit of both, and that's a really good point, is that a lot of the money that has come into the economy, a lot of money that's flown back into businesses, a lot of businesses are not necessarily spending on CapEx and are not necessarily hiring. Some are, and we've seen the result of that, but many are not, and many have been buying back their stock. And that is a big concern for some people. You know, a lot of people, there's even been a movement afoot kind of along the lines of the MMT movement we were talking about earlier, where people are saying, progressive people are saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't allow stock buybacks in the way that that they've been going in the past. That would be a real kind of intrusion on corporate freedoms. You know, it's their stock. They can buy it back. They can do whatever they want with their money. But there's absolutely no doubt that a lot of companies have looked at that as a strategy. Because again, you know, they look forward, they look at the economy right now, they look at the global economy in particular, they see the United States economy is looking pretty healthy. And these large companies that have global footprints, they look at the global economy and they say, you know, we see what's going on in Europe, we see issues going on with China, maybe we don't want to make capital investment right now because that's expensive and it's a risk and we don't want to take the risk when the global economy is looking a little shaky, and therefore we'll just buy our stock back as well. So, you know, these companies are constantly making these risk assessments and deciding where they're going to put their surplus cash if they have surplus cash. And one safe way to do that, to also deduce their stock price a little bit and make themselves look good in the eyes of the rest of the country through the stock market, is to buy back stock. And that has been a trend that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Okay, so a mixed bag there. Well, let's look more closely at Americans' debt and what economists call household deleveraging. Outstanding car loan debt and student debt have doubled since the Great Recession. What is deleveraging?
Well, deleveraging is basically paying off your debt. So, you know, when people talk about deleveraging in the United States economy, they're talking about all of the debt that we have on the Fed's balance sheet and paying that money off. And the same, of course, goes with regular households. If you're deleveraging, you're taking money that you might spend on things, and instead you're just paying off the debt that you have, whether it's student debt, household debt, auto loan debt, whatever type of debt it is. So deleveraging is simply paying off debt. It's just a fancy way of saying that word.
So you, Planet Money, and The Indicator have been looking at debt more closely. Mm. You talked with Mary Rickman, who has lived and worked on her small dairy farm near Fremont, Wisconsin for 60 years, and her family is $300,000 in debt. Here's Mary.
We're just going to keep on struggling and struggling until there's nothing left to struggle for anymore, because this is our home. You know, and everybody says, well, maybe you should just sell it out. Oh, that's fine and dandy, but what do we do then? And how do we pay the bills that we owe? How what do we do then? John and I are too old to be able to get a job anywhere.
Well, what did you learn from Mary's story?
Well, we learned a couple of things. Firstly, that small farms, of which she has one, of course, are in a much worse state than a lot of people thought they were. You know, they have really been hit hard by this tariff war with China. If you're selling, if you're producing products that you were selling into the Chinese market and getting a reasonably good rate for, those revenues have just gone away at this point. So smaller farms that have a much smaller margin for error than large agribusinesses have, of course, they're really finding themselves pinched, and they are just racking up debt as a result. And of course, you know, we live in this country where it's actually relatively easy to get debt. It's a lot harder to get loans in other parts of the world. Americans' debt culture is actually pretty ingrained, and it's actually relatively easy for businesses and individuals to get credit. So what's happened with the Rickmans is they've racked up debt over a period. And of course, these are what we call bridge loans. You hope that they're going to bridge you from a time when things were good to the next time when things get good again. So when the market picks up, you hope, you know, you're going to be able to bring more revenue in. When the market picks up again, you can actually sell your goods, and then you can use that money to deleverage, to pay off that debt. But the problem is that because the trade war is dragging on, because prices in the United States are low because of the incursion of agribusiness who are able to sell, you know, their goods at a cheaper rate, these small farms are not able to make that bridge. The money is running out, and a lot of them are going out of business. And it's a tragic thing, both for those individual, those farmers themselves, but secondly, for the communities in which they exist, because that erodes the ability of those communities to survive. But thirdly, it impacts our food supply, because it means that we're, you know, getting all of our goods from only a small number of companies. And that lack of diversification within the food supply is not a good thing.
So as household debt rises among American families, what do economists worry about there?
Well, so the big thing that, well, let's get this into perspective, right? Firstly, total debt is huge right now in the United States. It's $13.95 trillion, nearly $14 trillion in debt at the end of the third quarter. That's from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So that's a massive amount of debt. And yes, auto debt is climbing. Student loan debt is massive. You know, it's way more than it was at the end of the financial crisis, nearly double, I believe. But here's the thing. Let's get this into perspective. Household debt is only now about 73% of GDP versus about 83% a decade ago. So even though debt is high, as a proportion of GDP, it's actually lower. Delinquencies, although they appear relatively high, are much lower than they were ahead of the financial crisis. You know, mortgage debt is by far the largest chunk of this debt. It's about two-thirds of household debt, which is pretty stable. A lot of people worry about student loan debt, of course, and it has doubled since the crisis. It is now the second largest category of consumer debt.
Medical
debt also very high. But the fact is that overall, and you know, individually, these examples like Mary Rickman's are tragic, but overall, as a share of the economy, economists are not that bothered about it at the moment, because people seem to be handling their debt reasonably well. The reason for this is, of course, that more people are being employed. Wages are creeping up slowly. They're not going up as fast as people would like, but at least more people are being employed, so they're able to handle those debts a little better. The problem is, and this is what economists worry about, we are in this situation in the economy where everybody is borrowing on very, very low interest rates. If the economy turns around and starts to go down, you're going to see interest rates spike very, very quickly. And when that happens, all of that debt is going to come calling. So that large amount of consumer debt could—it's kind of like, you know, toddling along the street with, you know, boxes stacked up on you. Mm. You're kind of managing those boxes reasonably well, but as soon as you hit a little bump in the curb
or a gust
crack
of wind
in the sidewalk,
uh-huh.
or a gust of wind, as soon as you hit headwinds, you're right, you're top heavy, you could tilt over, and things could go very badly wrong very quickly as a result. So that's what economists are worried about. They're worried about the future, not necessarily the present.
Patty Hirsch, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. We're recapping the year in economics with your questions and your financial situations that you see. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Patty, the unemployment rate here in Wisconsin was historically low this year, hovering around 3%. Homelessness, though, is a really huge problem, which makes you kind of wonder, is full employment actually a good thing? What can we learn from this metric, unemployment?
Well, the unemployment rate is it's a little flawed, right? Because it doesn't include everybody. When you hear this unemployment rate come in, it's about the people who are looking for work. And a lot of people have dropped off the working roles. So, what we've heard is that, when the Fed measures employment, we've seen it drop from, 6% all the way down to sort of 3.5% at this point. And we're thinking, wow, this is full employment. It's only full employment of those people who are looking for work and who are on the worker rolls. You've got all these people who, it was during the recession, had such a bad time looking for work. They just basically gave up and they went off the rolls. Those people are now starting to come back onto the rolls. So you see this number, this what it is, 3.5% right now, mm-hmm. keeps dropping lower and lower. And people say, well, so what's full employment then? Well, full employment is only full employment if everybody is employed. And clearly, a lot of people are not employed, and we're seeing a lot of those people living in housing, living in homeless encampments around the country. Now, this is something slightly different, right? Because we've got a housing crisis in this country where we're just not building enough homes, and there are a variety of reasons for that. I mean, the cost of the four L's, as I like to say, labor, lumber, loans, and land are still very, very high. And that means and also combine that with regulation in large cities, it makes it difficult or disincentivizes developers to actually build, which is one of the reasons we don't have enough housing stock. If we had more housing stock and people were able to afford it, then we would have fewer homeless on the street. But the fact is that the unemployment rate, as we're looking at it right now, seems a little flawed. People are kind of losing faith in it, and they're looking at different types of metrics to judge whether or not the economy is doing well or not.
We are getting an economics explainer. We're rewinding on the year with Patty Hirsch. She's an economics and finance news correspondent. Are you a millennial? How have current economic conditions informed the decisions you made in your life? What do you think people get wrong about millennials' financial decisions? Have you recovered from the Great Recession? What questions do you have about downturns and economic indicators? Join in with economic questions, banking system questions, your insights along the way, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a moment with Patty Hirsch for the hour right here on the Ideas Network. It's an economics explainer here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking at the year in review. Recession fears were sparked earlier this year when the yield curve inverted, which is a key indicator of a pending downturn. So what concerns you about the economic conditions ahead in 2020? What confuses you most about yield curves or how our financial systems fit together? And what about the bond market? Ask away, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Patty Hirsch stays with us. He's editor of the Planet Money podcast called The Indicator. Let's go back to the phones now. John is joining us from Phillips this morning. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you? Hello to you and your guest. In the 70s, one particular party come up with the idea of baseline budgeting. And we've been using it ever since. And like, say, in 2018, about $3.7 trillion went into the government coffers, but $3.2 trillion was already spent, and none of that going toward the debt. So when Congress gets together to work about a budget, they're only arguing about $3.2 billion. And all the programs that all of that money goes to, it's never investigated to see whether it's actually going there, whether those programs are working or not.
Hmm.
And if we continue baseline budgeting, we'll never pay down the debt.
I don't entirely disagree with you there, John. I mean, it's very interesting to look at the way government runs its business, you know, but let's be real. I mean, this is an enormous bureaucracy we're talking about. It's clear that there's in any bureaucracy, there's going to be fat in the system, and these things need to be monitored all the time in order to make sure that they're as efficient as possible. Of course, that takes even more staff to monitor that process, which of course increases the size of government. You know, I think you're right. I mean, it's a relatively small amount of money that people are talking about. You know, in terms of the overall amount that is on the Federal Reserve, that is on the government's balance sheet. It's a relatively small amount of money that we're talking about in the budget each time, which is why I think that there's such a fight about it. And this is one of the things that these people who espouse modern monetary theory will talk about. They'll say, well, you know, why don't we just, you know, print money in order to solve these issues? Frankly, I think that that would be inflationary and dangerous, but, you know, that is the debate. So I'd be very interested to hear, if you'd like to email me, I'd be love to hear your thoughts on that if you do a little reading on it.
John, thanks for the call. Let's go to Doug now in Rice Lake. Hi, Doug.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yes, my comment comes more in the micro instead of the macro. I am a landlord in the Rice Lake area, and what I find many times, people who come to rent from me, they have ruined their credit, and as a result, they have to get they can only rent, and so they aren't in a position to buy. And so, because if you buy, you're actually going to have less payments per month than what you pay me for rent. Now, I say, well, where is the problem? Why is this happening? And I think it's in our households where we're not teaching the next generation how to save money, how to manage money, and to use it to get us ahead. Any other place, I feel we could do a better job in the schools.
Yeah.
And have
so
a
you're
mandate.
Definitely seeing yep. some financial education, and really that starts at home and in the schools. Doug, thanks for the call. You know, he's a landlord and notices that you know, the people who come to rent, it's because they can't buy.
Yeah, this is it's very interesting. Well, here, first things first. I mean, I am not entirely sure why everybody is so obsessed with buying homes, right? I come from a cult. Well, the United Kingdom is very similar to the United States, and that home buying, it's like you want to have your own home, and that's kind of the holy grail. In Europe, it's not the case at all. In Europe, most people are renting. You know, people in Germany, people like to have to buy homes, but in France and Italy, everyone's a renter, and there's no kind of people don't see any stigma attached to that. So it's an interesting cultural thing. But you know, Doug is absolutely right that a lot of people's their credit is shot. You know, it's shot for 7 years. They come to try and buy, and you know, banks, of course, who are doing the lending are very gun shy now, and of course, part of that is regulatory. They're not able to make those loans, and so that crimps the ability of people to buy as well. So it means that you're seeing this rise of the renter. And over the last 10 years, we've actually seen many more people. I think, you know, the rental market has increased by 30%, you know, over the last 10 years. And part of this is because people's credit is so bombed, because, you know, it is relatively easy to borrow in the United States, but it's also relatively easy to default on those loans, whether they be auto loans, mortgage loans, or home loans. And that does that crimps that part of the housing market. And, you know, the other thing I think is interesting is that, you know, Doug is he's a landlord. You know, he wants to he is in this situation where he's one of these people who is faced with the incentives or lack of incentives produced in the housing market by individual municipalities that make rules about, you know, who can rent and at what rates. You know, we're hearing a lot about municipalities that are trying to cap rents, and I'd be very interested to hear from Doug about how he feels about the possibility that his rents might be capped and how that might disincentivize him from being a landlord.
Doug, have you pushed up rents at all, or do you have any type of cap that you have to consistently follow?
My cap is I evaluate the market mechanism.
Your cap is the market. And I think, you know, that's the way I think most landlords want to proceed. They're like, you know, we don't have, you know, regulations telling us how much we can or cannot charge, because the regulation means that, you know, it restricts us and it makes us, it gives us less flexibility. And I would suspect, Doug, tell me if I'm wrong, that the less flexibility that you have as a landlord, the less incentive you have to develop homes and, you know, keep them in good shape for upcoming renters.
Not only incentive, I won't be able to keep them up to the standards.
Yeah.
Right. So I think it's really interesting to hear that point of view, because I think a lot of people don't think about the landlord's point of view when they're talking about putting caps on rents.
We're talking with Patty Hirsch, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. Still a few moments here for you, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Charles now in Eau Claire. Hi, Charles. What's your question?
Good morning. So on the topic of debt and credit and defaulting on your loans, we've all heard of how detrimental the student loan debt crisis is in America. I've heard from a couple educated individuals that ending the federally insured student loan program would be beneficial. I honestly agree. It would make students more accountable to actually know how to pay for their schooling rather than just get loans. And it's super easy to, as a student speaking myself. I would be curious, what do you think of that? What do you think of ending the federally insured student loan program?
Well, it's an idea that people have talked about a lot. The problem is, of course, if you end the federal ability to borrow with the help of the government, who do you borrow from? Then suddenly you're at the mercy of the market. Now, you're right. Over time, that might correct the market, because, you know, it means that if people have more difficulty borrowing, it means that there's going to be less money flowing into the into those universities, and that might force them to do things that, you know, to charge proper rates, and also to manage their businesses better and not spending huge amounts of money on football stadiums or whatever it is that actually inflate those costs and drive the cost of education up as high as it is. So I think that could in the long term happen, but it's very, very speculative, and you've got to bridge that gap. You know, who helps those students make those loans? Is it going to be individual households? Think how that's going to crimp households in the short term. You know, suddenly individual households are going to be paying way more, and their student debt load goes up. So, you know, I think it's an interesting idea, but I think it's a dangerous one, because we're talking about such a large economy that depends so much on students at this point going to college, because that idea hasn't been challenged properly. I think, you know, why don't we move towards a European model where very many fewer people go to universities and instead go to apprenticeships, where they can actually move into a high-paying job after their education? So I think that, you know, this is just one of the conversations, or one of the ideas that's come up in conversation. Not a bad one, but one for the long term as opposed to the short term.
Patty, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kate. Thank you. And thanks very much to your listeners for calling in.
Patty Hirsch, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money, and he joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Coming up, we get analysis on last night's Democratic presidential primary debate. Did you watch? What candidates stood out to you? How is the field looking ahead of the Iowa caucuses? Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.